You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Good evening. I'm Arye Naya. I am President Emeritus of the Open Society Foundations, and it's my pleasure to preside this evening over a discussion of what I think is an extraordinary book. The book is entitled Incitement on Trial, Prosecuting International Speech Crimes, and it is written by Richard Ashby Wilson. I will introduce the speakers this evening before we start the discussion. But I want to say just a few words about the book before we get started. I think it's an extraordinary book because Professor Wilson draws not only on international law, but also on social science research and also on the philosophy of language. Discussing the question of incitement to commit great crimes. And incitement has been an immensely important issue in the international criminal jurisprudence that has taken place in the nearly quarter of a century since the establishment of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. It has figured in the jurisprudence of the ICTY. It has figured in the jurisprudence of the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. It has figured in the jurisprudence of the International Criminal Court. And it has figured in this international criminal jurisprudence because the kinds of crimes that are adjudicated by those tribunals often result or may result from periods in which there has been an effort to generate hatred against a minority. That is, ethnic cleansing in ex-Yugoslavia, genocide in Rwanda, and other such crimes involve the dissemination of hate. We have a number of current examples of that sort of thing. One that I think is particularly significant is what is now taking place in Myanmar, in Burma, with respect to the Rohingyas. To what degree did the incitement of hate or the incitement of crimes play a part in the forced exodus of several hundred thousand Rohingyas and the killing and rape and other abuses suffered by the Rohingyas. So all of that is part of our discussion this evening. The author of Incitement on Trial, Richard Ashby Wilson, is going to speak first and talk about some of the main arguments of the book. Richard Wilson is the Gladstein Distinguished Chair of Human Rights at the University of Connecticut. I should say to those who may know the Open Society Foundations, the name Gladstein actually is very important in this institution. That is, Gary Gladstein was a business associate of George Soros. He was the business associate George relied on most in the creation of the Open Society Institute. So I dealt with Gary Gladstein quite extensively in the period as that the Open Society Institute was being established. And independently, Gary Gladstein has endowed the chair of human rights at the University of Connecticut. Professor Wilson is also professor of law and anthropology at the University of Connecticut, and he is currently a visiting scholar at the Russell Sage Foundation. And then in the order in which we'll proceed, we are very fortunate to have Nadine Strossen, my longtime friend and colleague, on video. Nadine was the president of the American Civil Liberties Union from 1991 to 2008. She is the John Marshall Harlan Professor of Law at New York Law School, and one of the reasons, or the reason, that she is on video rather than present here this evening is she has a class this evening, and therefore by taking part in this discussion by video, she can go directly into her class. And Nadine is also known particularly as a scholar and advocate for freedom of speech, and she is the author of a forthcoming book on hate speech. And then we have with us on the panel Professor Marko Milanović. He is Associate Professor of Law at the University of Nottingham School of Law, and he is Vice President of the European Society of International Law. And I asked him before the panel started whether he might say something about one extraordinary case that is discussed in Professor Wilson's book, discussed at length in Professor Wilson's book, and that is the unfortunate trial of Vojislav Šešelj before the International Criminal Tribunal for the Yugoslavia. I'd make my own comment, and that is, for those of you who, like me, followed the wars in the former Yugoslavia, many of you may think that of all the scoundrels in that conflict, Šešelj deserves to be put at the top of the list. Nevertheless, after spending a long period in confinement in advance of trial, in part because of contempt of court that he had engaged in a number of times during the pretrial proceedings, Šešelj was eventually acquitted by the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. And there is a lengthy but, to me, riveting chapter of Professor Wilson's book that deals with the Šešelj case. And then, last but not least, we have also on the screen, I can't see her at this moment, but I think you can, and I'll move to the audience when she speaks. Linda Lakdir, the legal advisor of the Asia Division of Human Rights Watch. And Linda Lakdir is a former federal criminal prosecutor with the U.S. Department of Justice. And we particularly wanted her to talk a little bit about The current situation in Rakhine state in Burma, and the exodus of the Rohingyas, and the degree to which incitement may have played a part in the disastrous events that have been unfolding in Myanmar. So with that, I would now like to call on Professor Wilson to tell us about his book.
Thanks very much, Arye, and welcome to all of you. I'm going to summarize the book in, I was given 12 to 15 minutes, and as you can see, it's a very thick book, so I'm just going to pull out a few of the themes. But I'd just like to start with a thanks to Sandra Colliver for her excellent coordination of the event, and Arya Nair for moderating and taking an interest. Also to the commentators, Linda Lochdear, Marco Milanovic, and Nadine Strossen. I can't think of a better panel to review the book and comment on it. So writing a book entails toiling in years of solitude when you think no one cares. And when I picked this issue, I really thought it was kind of marginal. A wonderful event like this makes it all worthwhile. So thank you all for coming. I was originally drawn to this question of incitement, particularly incitement to genocide, in 2003 when the media trial gave its judgment at the Rwanda Tribunal in Arusha in Tanzania. And it convicted broadcasters of RTLM for inciting the genocide, for instigating the genocide, for aiding and abetting the genocide. And crucially, it held media owners criminally liable for their ownership of RTLM, for their position of ownership. This was later overturned by the appeals chamber. But this was really a groundbreaking decision on the part of an international tribunal, and it generated a lot of controversy. Diane Orenschleicher, a law professor from American University, supported by OSF at the time, wrote a scathing review of the inconsistencies in the judgment, the overreach, and her concerns were well-founded. So this was a very messy and controversial area of international law. There's a lot of agreement on war crimes, and the conviction rate is very, very high. War crimes go back, you know, to Grotius. You can 400 years of documented national and international law on war crimes. But incitement and speech crimes, very new, it's very unsettled, it's very uncertain, lots of contradictions, and very little in the way of international consensus. So I took a quick look at the constitutions of the world, and only 34 out of the 198 that were on the database that I checked had any kind of incitement to hatred, incitement to violence provision. So that's really a minority. So I started with then a bunch of questions. Why is this such an unsettled area of law, of international law? How might it be more consistent? Why do speech crimes trials, as Arya Nair mentioned, at international tribunals, at trials like the Sheshel trial, so often end in acquittal? Here is Sheshel, the worst scoundrel, calling for the worst kinds of crimes to be committed against non-Serbs, and he's acquitted of all 9 counts. Now, that was a strange trial in many ways, but there's something deep there, which is that it's kind of indicative of international law's ambivalence towards suppressing freedom of expression, even during armed conflict and even during ongoing and systematic attacks on a civilian population. Another question I had was, how might the preventative capacity of incitement be augmented, since it's only ever been charged after a genocide has already occurred? So incitement is put into the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Genocide in 1948, but it's never used preventatively. It's only been charged in the Rwandan case after all the bodies are already in the ground. So how can this area of law be more consistent and be used preventatively in the way that it was designed to be used? I do want to say I'm not gung-ho about suppressing speech and prohibiting forms of expression. I try and take a cautious and sensible approach to delineating the limits of these prohibitions and trying to provide clearer boundaries for when it's relevant and when it's not relevant. So just to pick up on one thread through the book, I'll start with this question of why is the rate of conviction so low? So the majority of convictions for speech crimes in the international setting are for inchoate crimes. This is the only bit of law jargon I'm going to use today. Inchoate crimes are crimes where the conduct is the crime, the act itself, not the consequences. So in U.S. law, we have three types of inchoate crimes: attempt, conspiracy, and solicitation. So solicitation of a murder is a crime, regardless of whether the person you're soliciting takes up the idea and takes substantial steps to complete the underlying crime. So the majority, 75% of convictions, are for inchoate crimes. And the vast majority are for direct and public incitement to genocide. There are really only two inchoate crimes: inciting genocide and hate speech, but hate speech is not well established. There's really only one case that's been confirmed on appeal. The vast majority of convictions are for inciting genocide, and they're all in the Rwanda tribunal. The acquittals mostly happen in another area of completed crimes. For instance, instigating crimes against humanity or inducing crimes against humanity, where the prosecution has to show a causal nexus between the speech act and the subsequent offenses. This is very hard to prove. It's very hard to demonstrate that the speech was the cause of the crimes and not some other reasons. Maybe the people had planned the attack already on the village. Maybe the army had been involved arming them. Maybe practical assistance had been provided elsewhere. Maybe they were going to do it anyway, and the speech was simply an act of confirmation of the plans that already existed. So it's very hard to show that the speech act itself, as it should be hard to prove, that it had a direct causal effect beyond a reasonable doubt. There are logistical reasons for this. You need insiders. You need followers to testify that they heard the words of Sheshel, for example, and they acted on it. But often they drop out. These insiders drop out during the course of the trial. Many times they're bribed or intimidated, or worse, they get on the stand and then recant and defect to the defense, as we saw in Sheshel a couple of times. There are deeper conceptual reasons for why it's so hard to prove this direct causal connection. And that is, according to my review of the social science literature, this is simply not how propagandistic speech works. Its effects are indirect, and it seldom makes an essential contribution to a genocide or an attack on a population. So while the criminal court is looking for this direct causal nexus, that's simply not the way speech works. Its effects are more unconscious. They're more indirect. It may be jointly sufficient, but seldom is it making an essential contribution of the type a criminal court is looking for. As a result of the insiders dropping out and the deep conceptual problems, prosecutors often, and I've seen this in Sheshel, but in many other trials as well, particularly at the Yugoslav tribunal, they turn to rather weak chronological arguments. This is where the defendant spoke, and look what happened next. This is where he spoke, and then there was this violence. He gave this inflammatory speech, and then look what happened next. But judges are not often persuaded by this. They ask questions of the kind that I've just mentioned. What else was going on in the scenario? How do we know the speech itself was causal? Perhaps plans were in place. Perhaps the speech was mere rhetoric that was icing on the cake and the cake was already cooked elsewhere. I just used a metaphor. When judges are convinced, they often use metaphors in their judgments. If you read the Rwanda convictions, there are all these metaphors about how speech is a fire or a conflagration, or speech spread petrol around the country and then lit the match. They refer, and this is at Nuremberg, they referred to anti-Semitism as a virus spread by Stryker and Fritz that then poisoned the minds of Germans. So they use these metaphors of fire, of poison, of weapons, and these metaphors are misleading, and I would argue just plain wrong. No social scientist of persuasion and communication uses a hypodermic needle metaphor to say that a virus of anti-Semitism is injected into the minds. Those models are from the 1950s, but judges are still using them, even though social science has left them long behind. So that's 10 minutes. So I'm going to come to my... It's impossible. I'm reminded of the artist who said, "What does your..." When asked, "What does your painting mean?" he said, if I could express it in words, I wouldn't have painted it. So if I could express my book in 10 minutes, I wouldn't have written 356 pages. So anyway, that being said, recommendations. My recommendations are to prosecutors, charge inchoate crimes, not completed crimes. Use the framework of international criminal law more preventatively, but cautiously, and only in the most egregious cases where a speech act directly advocates a crime such as genocide and where the context is such that mass atrocities are imminent and likely. For lawyers in the room who thinks this sounds like Brandenburg, it sounds a lot like Brandenburg, which is the U.S. First Amendment case on incitement. This involves, however, an assessment of risk, which is always speculative and very difficult to conduct. So that comes to recommendation two. It brings us to recommendation two. When assessing risk in a deteriorating situation where a political leader or leaders or radio broadcasters or media figures are calling for attacks on protected groups, steer away from these folk models of speech and instead try and rigorously identify the conditions most likely to lead to imminent lawless action, which requires us to look at the social science of persuasion and political communication, which is telling us that there are factors that elevate risk. And I include these in my book. They include the authority of the speaker, their credibility, their charisma, their graphic use of language, their calls for revenge. There's some research in the book that shows that revenge language seems to be the type of language which has the strongest effects on listeners in the kind of scenarios we're speaking about, perhaps even more than dehumanizing language. Look at the emotional state of the audience. So these are the kind of factors. And something that's been crucially identified by persuasion research is that you can persuade people, but often they'll be persuaded and then go away and do nothing. So if a speaker identifies a clear and tangible violent course of action that can be undertaken imminently and by the audience, then it's much more likely to occur. So I've tried to outline some of these, and I've listed 11 factors that courts may use. And I argue not just prosecutors, but judges in pretrial, defense attorneys too. Let's tie ourselves to the mask of some rigorous factors that we all agree on. The problem is you often have the prosecution emphasizing one group of factors and the defense another. So we need to get over time to build up a consensus of the types of situations where the risk is elevated to such an extent that it justifies this very rare intervention on the part of an international tribunal. A note of pragmatism. Knowing what types of speech acts and situations may cause violence doesn't solve the problem of how to react to it. This is a policy choice. And I think, in my experience, the only way to get lawyers to agree to a role for social science or science generally is by insisting on a strong distinction between understanding the material facts and then making the legal and policy determinations separately from that. The problem in international courts is that these processes of determining the facts and determining the policy happen all together and they're mushed up. and I'm trying to separate them so that we can bring in the social science to understand the material fact patterns, and that we still may decide, well, put it this way, it doesn't determine what our policy choices may then be. How do we apply this? So I thought of a few examples. Sandra Colliver asked me to talk a little bit about Burma, but thankfully we have Linda here to speak about it, and other experts who wish to apply it. I would say that while there have been a lot of failures with regard to the conviction of political leaders for inciting crimes against humanity and genocide, indictments do concentrate the mind and may deter further calls for violence. And I think we have seen this in Africa over about the last 2 to 3 years. In Kenya, I think there has been a deterrent effect by the indictments issued by the International Criminal Court in the case particularly of Ruto and Tsang. Even though that case failed and they were acquitted, the recent elections were less marred by interethnic violence than in the 1990s or than in previous election episodes. During the Nigerian elections of 2015, the chief prosecutor, Bensouda, who went to law school in Nigeria, went to Lagos twice, and she gave press conferences that were very well covered by the Nigerian media, saying the ICC is monitoring the Nigerian elections, monitoring the language of incitement very closely, and will issue indictments if political leaders whip up interethnic violence during the elections, as they have done in the past. And I think that did have an effect. It's interesting that she went there twice, and what she talked about was inciting language. Now, these are secondary effects of international tribunals. The aim of the book is to make the primary effects of tribunals on speech crimes more consistent and coherent. Buy the book, read it, decide yourselves whether I've succeeded, or even just buy the book. It's outside, by the way.
Thank you very much. I'm now going to call on Nadine. Before I do so, I want to raise a free speech concern myself. And the free speech concern, you said this is like Brandenburg, and you talked about the imminence of violence. It's very different when we are in the international arena. You mention in your book the Streicher case, in which the Nuremberg Tribunal convicted and Julius Streicher was hanged after his conviction. He was essentially hanged because of the virulent anti-Semitism in his newspaper, Der Stürmer, several years prior to the war. His newspaper did function during the war itself. It had, at that point, a fairly minuscule circulation. And Telford Taylor, who was a prosecutor at Nuremberg and afterwards the chief prosecutor at Nuremberg, expresses doubt about whether Streicher should have been convicted and hanged, a despicable character, no doubt. But Taylor says he had no contact with the forces that were committing the crimes in Poland and in the Soviet Union. He wasn't in contact with Himmler, who was in charge of the campaigns against the Jews, Can we really talk about immanence in the Brandenburg sense when we have somebody removed in that fashion, both in time and in space, from the actual commission of the crimes? At any rate, let me now turn this over to Nadine Strossen. Nadine?
Well, thank you so much, Ari, and it's delightful to be there and at New York Law School at the same time. So I have to thank Blue Jeans Technology for that wonderful possibility of what I thought was impossible. Richard, I agree with Ari that it's just really a fascinating and important book, and I've only had time to read it once, which is not enough, and it really is going to give me a lot to think about and to integrate into my own analysis about the American situation. I was struck that at the very beginning, literally on page 2 of your book, you say it is worth noting at the outset that the speech acts adjudicated at international criminal tribunals are generally far removed from the typical instances of threatening or denigrating speech found in national criminal courts. And I think this contextual distinction is really important. You go on to say speakers charged with international speech crimes have generally articulated the most extreme animus and conscious intent to harm and have gone beyond mere insult, libel, and slander to incite others to commit mass atrocities. Moreover, their utterances usually occur in a context of an armed conflict, genocide, and a widespread or systematic attack on a civilian population. So I took that from the outset as imposing a lot of limiting contextual criteria on the still relatively limited, and I think very, as you said, consciously speech respectful standard that you lay out. That said, like Aria, I still have some questions. And I, as a law professor, of course, I'm tempted to ask you directly what application, if any, you would propose for the U.S. Would you propose, for example, that we should honor an inchoate crime of hate speech or incitement other than the Brandenburg standard? I think the answer is no, but I'd like to hear that. I would like to, my one quibble is that you make a statement also fairly early on in the book, I believe on page 19, that hate speech has a specific legal meaning in the United States, and that in fact is not true. It is not a legal term of art. For a very important reason, namely that the U.S. Supreme Court has never recognized or defined any content-defined category of speech called hate speech or speech that has a hateful message, which is for that reason unprotected under the First Amendment. Rather, along with speech, with any message or content, the court has said, in certain contexts, when it directly causes a specific imminent serious harm, then but only then may speech with a hateful or inciting message be punished. And one of the subcategories of speech that satisfies what I call an emergency standard is, of course, the incitement standard, the very strict incitement standard from the Brandenburg case. I want to say a little bit about that because it is the basis of your definition, Richard, as we've already discussed. But I also think it's important because I assume audience members are concerned about the American situation as well, where we have had a lot of calls recently to increase our punishment of speech that is feared to, that carry a hateful message and fear to incite or instigate various adverse consequences, including violence. But also psychological and emotional harm. The Brandenburg case, which came about from an ACLU case, although before both REAs and my time, with the ACLU in 1969, although the immediate beneficiary of a very speech protective standard was a member of a Ku Klux Klan who was making this statement at a rally of Klan members. The court said that the speech had to be not only intended to, but likely to bring about immediate harm or, you know, violence or law breaking. So both intended and likely, and the harm had to be imminent. And it drew a bright line distinction between what it called mere advocacy versus intentional incitement. So the immediate beneficiary was a racist white supremacist. But in 1969, there's no doubt that given the social political context, the court was very aware that attempts were made to suppress speech by activists on the complete opposite end of the ideological spectrum, right? Civil rights demonstrators all over the country were attempted to and were shut down by local officials arguing that they were inciting violence and bringing about great harm to national security and stability. The women's movement was then engaged in controversial demonstrations, reproductive freedom movement, and the Stonewall riots, let's not forget, were on the horizon. So beneficiaries of this very speech protective standard certainly included human rights advocates. And I always have to remind people of that, because when people want to suppress speech, they always think it's going to fall on the speech that they dislike. But beware, the opposite message is also going to be endangered. When you think of those extreme contextual examples that you set out at the beginning of your book, Richard, and some of the other examples that you described in the context of ongoing genocide, and you also talk at another point, use the phrase mass atrocities. This is what we're talking about in the international context. It's a very far cry from what's being attacked and sought to be suppressed, and in many cases actually suppressed here in the United States under the same rubric, right? People use the word hate speech and hate crime and even violence and assault against, most recent example I'm aware of is a new play by Michael Weller that was attacked as hate speech and therefore suppressed at Brandeis University. Yesterday, there was an article in USA Today by a Cornell law professor who was attacked for engaging in hate speech and posing a danger at Vassar College because he was giving a lecture entitled Why Hate Speech is Protected, Free Speech Under the First Amendment. So I think it's very sobering to consider speech that actually satisfies a very appropriately rigorous standard for directly contributing to genocide and other mass atrocities, as opposed to the kinds of alleged harm that are being raised in this country as a supposed justification for suppressing speech. One of the things that I found so fascinating about your book, Richard, is this drawing together, an apparently unique drawing together, of legal standards with rigorous analysis and drawing upon social science, as Arye said, not only social science, but also language, linguistics, and various other empirical studies to rigorously break down factors that would be considered in determining whether there is a sufficient intent and whether there is a sufficient causal impact, and how do we assess that? And you really highlighted the extent to which we often rely on common sense and assumptions. And what is very sobering and a real wake-up call is the extent to which social science and evidence belies standard assumptions. For example, I think it's very common, this has already been touched upon, it's widely assumed that the most harmful kinds of hate speech or hateful speech are those that are dehumanizing. And you yourself underscore what a surprising result it was that, at least in some factual context, and you're very careful to say that from one context to another it may vary, but at least in some, it was not dehumanizing speech that had the greatest potential harmful impact. So this is very interesting and very exciting. I think in the United States, to the best of my knowledge, the empirical evidence that's beginning to be cited in debates about so-called hate speech has to do with psychological harm, emotional harm. And again, the common sense assumption is, well, if words are hurtful and hateful, it must be psychically damaging to you, and therefore shouldn't colleges protect students against that speech? And it's very interesting that you have Jonathan Haidt and other prominent social psychologists saying, well, no, actually there is psychological evidence that it, at least in certain contexts with certain kinds of educational responses, exposing students to that kind of speech can actually be positive for their mental health and for their psychological development. So this is part of an emerging blending of scientific knowledge and legal theory that I think is very promising and very exciting. In fairness, in the United States, probably because we have such a strong presumption in favor of free speech, judges have been very skeptical about social scientific evidence that supposedly justifies suppressing speech because of some harm that it can cause. There have been two major categories, contexts in which this has arisen here. One is certain speech is either outlawed altogether because it is believed to lead to certain people who view it to engage in harmful acts. And the most recent example in a case that went to the Supreme Court was violent video games that are marketed to minors. And the court found that the social scientific evidence just didn't show any causal connection at all between minors being exposed to violent video games and actually committing any kind of violent act. The other context, which hasn't gotten to the Supreme Court, but to a lot of lower courts, is trying to hold distributors or creators of, and here our target has mostly been expressly violent media, seems to be in the spotlights of legislators and litigators. So there have been attempts by tort lawsuits to hold producers of violent media productions at least partially capable, culpable for crimes that are committed, like the school shootings committed after visiting certain violent websites. And again, the courts have been very skeptical of the social scientific evidence there. So I'm going to definitely be citing a lot of the empirical evidence that you cited, Richard, in my future talks, asking people to be very skeptical about the allegedly adverse impact of hated inciting speech in the United States. And I really look forward to your answers to REA's question and to my question.
Thank you very much, Nadine. Professor Milanovic.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure, as always, Richard. And I have my predecessors very much enjoyed reading your book. And the book really does have many virtues that deserve it being bought, especially for lawyers. And the analytically, the part that I really there are two parts that I really like the most about the book. One is the exploration of causation. Because causation is something that lawyers have, for example, like issues of intention as well. always been questions that lawyers have been, concepts that lawyers have used all the time for thousands of years, literally, but have been methodologically very sloppy about that. And the other is use of expert evidence and the role of experts in the courtroom and so on. So those parts of the book really fascinated me the most. Now, I think it's important to distinguish, between several different issues that we could be talking about here. So one is the question that Nadine was really discussing, which is hate speech in this sort of domestic internal context, which produces some social harms, but does not lead to or is not a precursor to or does not arise in the context of something that happened in my country, which is mass atrocity. So the American context and the American approach to free speech is not the same problem as hate speech in Germany or hate speech in Yugoslavia. So my one item of caution with regard to what Nadine just said is that we should not generalize also from this book necessarily to the American experience, and we should not generalize from the American experience to other societies. So what's good for the United States need not be good for Germany or for Serbia or whoever. My second point is that I think we should all agree, and we are in agreement, that most cases of hateful propaganda will not be legally actionable under international criminal court. Even in principle, let alone in practice. So the in principle question is what the law substantively would cover and treat as a crime. The in practice issue is if you are a prosecutor with very limited resources and you have many, many, many fish to fry, who are you going to focus on? And it is rare that a pure propagandist type case will actually be prosecuted. There are many worse cases that are easier to prove or more deserving of legal action. And this will be true even in cases where you had a huge propaganda effort that probably had an impact on these societies that is easy to prove in aggregate but difficult to prove when it comes to specific crimes being committed. I think very few people will dispute that hateful propaganda had an enormous impact on the wars in the Balkans, for example. But that is not necessarily the same thing as proving that specific person X committed crime Y because of any instance of speech. And indeed, most, if I look at the experience of the former Yugoslavia, most of the examples of hateful propaganda there were, I want to say, subtle. These are not exercises in subtlety. But they are not, let's go kill some Croats and Muslims, whatever. It's not that type of speech. Most of that revolves around creating, molding these victimhood narratives. So if you look at, for example, all the people in the former Yugoslavia, they all think they're the biggest victims in the world. And have been such victims for hundreds of years, normally at the hand of the other group. Yeah. So this is not the type of stuff that internationally would ever prosecute, I would suggest. Domestically, the irony is you can have domestic crimes, and in the former Yugoslavia, we have the inchoate crime of hate speech in most of these societies. Not that anybody of these hate mongers has ever been properly prosecuted for crimes that actually exist on the books. So, the mere existence or not of these crimes is not necessarily something that leads to actual enforcement. My third point is that you make many, many useful contributions in your book, but I think there's some caution that needs to be exercised in the sense that your sample is very small. So when you say the conviction rate is lower in these cases of speech crimes, we're talking about a handful of cases. Some of these cases, and I will now turn to the Şeşil case, really do not need to be overthought. One does not need a great theoretical explanation.
Academics, Marco.
Sure.
We overthink, therefore we are.
Who need to sell books. Who need to sell books. The Şeşil case, is one of those examples of situations that tell you that individual decisions matter, and that it matters who gets to do what and who gets which kind of job in some kind of institution. And when you have the wrong people in the wrong place at the wrong time, you're going to have disaster. So nobody in the Sheshel case was the A team of the ICTY. Let me put it that way. When it comes to the judges, we're not talking about A, B, or even C. And the French presiding judge of that trial was a crazy person. I mean, I'm being very generous here. Okay. And so when you have somebody like that, in that, you know, a guy who expresses his admiration towards the defendant while the trial is going on, when you have that type of thing happening, what exactly do you expect? And then the irony of that trial was that it wasn't the French guy alone who torpedoed the case. It was the fact that one of the two reasonable judges who, if I can quote the third one, Judge Latanzi, suffered greatly through the trial. This is what she said in her interview given to an Italian newspaper immediately after the trial was concluded, that the only way she could cope was because she had other cases. Yeah. So the third judge, Harhoff, is the one who torpedoed that trial in the end because he made this error of judgment in writing this email to a bunch of friends where he accused the president of the tribunal as being involved in an American conspiracy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which led to his disqualification from the case, which led to his replacement with a fourth guy who was also not in the A team, et cetera. Yeah. So these cases have explanations that, again, do not require necessarily grand theories. And in this case in particular, I think, does not. Okay. Now, my main point would be this, and let me wrap up with that. I agree with most of what you said here. What I do not necessarily agree with, or at least I do not think you is a matter you have approached with the same level of social scientific rigor, is the question of prevention. Because it's impossible. Agreed. So when you say, you know, my hope is that a better approach to this stuff will lead to a better calibration of the role of international criminal law in preventing or deterring crime, that is wishful thinking.
Yeah.
Judges don't understand causation. Thinking that a potential perpetrator will be deterred from committing a crime because, the judges have reached a better understanding of causation is, I don't think that's going to happen. No. If I am thinking of waging a hateful campaign against a group because I want to get power, money, et cetera, from it, the kind of things you are looking at in the book do not really touch me. As in most of these cases, what matters to me is the likelihood somebody's going to come after me for whatever that might be, whatever the particulars of the legal theory or the causal theory or whatever. So the fine conceptual theoretical points that you make, I think, matter for us. I don't think they matter for the perpetrators of these crimes. And in particular, I don't think the distinctions between, say, incitement and aiding and abetting and whatever, you know, that these things matter for them. Finally, my one cautionary note is this. There is one clear inchoate crime of this type, which is direct and public incitement to genocide, which is in the Genocide Convention, unfortunately, which has not been translated in that way into the Rome Statute of the ICC, and you spent quite a bit of time discussing it in the book. My one cautionary note is that most mass atrocities committed in the world today are not legally genocide. So if I say, for example, we should kill all the Serbs in New York, that is direct public incitement to genocide. If I say, let's kill all disabled people or all gay people in New York, that's not genocide, because gay people, disabled people are all not protected groups under the Genocide Convention. See what I mean? Cambodia, everybody here will say the Cambodian genocide, not legally a genocide, because one group of Cambodians was killing another group of Cambodians on the basis of their social class, not on the basis of ethnicity, religion, race. Yeah? So there is this tendency that we see all the time in activist communities and not in using this G word for purposes which I think ultimately leads to devaluing other international crimes. and there's a because crimes against humanity are not less bad than genocide. Huh? So, and it is not an inchoate crime to directly and publicly incite to commit crimes against humanity, or to directly and publicly incite to commit war crimes. It's only for genocide. So there's a danger when if we focus on this crime that we will devalue other crimes against international law, which is something I think needs to be avoided. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. But one case which may qualify for genocide, or at least attempted genocide, and attempted genocide is also a crime under the Genocide Convention, and is what is happening today with respect to the Rohingyas. And so we're now going to turn to Linda Lakhdir. Do we know to what degree incitement may have been a factor in the crimes that have taken place? And I should say that there are some, I'm one of them, who believe that an effort should be made to refer the Rohingya case to the International Criminal Court. And a few organizations are joining together to try to secure a Security Council referral. Linda.
Thank you. I do feel a bit at a disadvantage because I haven't read your book, Richard, because I got brought in late, but I look forward to reading it and hearing what you have to say. I would first say that we at Human Rights Watch certainly have not made a determination that this is a genocide or an attempted genocide, but we have made a legal determination that it is ethnic cleansing that amounts to crimes against humanity. And we also released a statement yesterday or the day before calling for an ICC referral. So we definitely are in agreement with you on that, the need for that referral. In terms of the role that hate speech may have played, should I assume that people know what's going on, or should I give a little bit of background on what's been happening?
I think a little bit of background would be helpful.
Okay. So the Rohingya Muslims in Burma are a population living in Rakhine State on the western part of Burma. There, before August of this year, there were approximately 1.1 million of them living in that area. They are effectively deprived of citizenship by Burmese law. They have been discriminated against for decades. And part of what's been going on over a period of time is sort of a continuing and progressive demonization of the Rohingya population. What has happened most recently is that there was an attack by a militant group calling itself the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army on military posts in Rakhine State that resulted in fatalities. And in response to that attack, the security forces, together with some local Rakhine Buddhists, have launched essentially a sort of scorched earth campaign of arson, rape, killing, and have driven over 600,000 of the population to flee to Bangladesh. So the question here is really, I guess, what role has hate speech played in that, and has there been direct incitement? And I think looking at the discussion that we've had, and certainly the standards that we at Human Rights Watch take for what actually constitutes incitement, there's a lot of hate speech out there. There's a huge propaganda campaign to make the Rohingya other, both as non-Burmese and as non-Buddhist. But as far as direct incitement to kill them, I think that's much harder to find. There is a very strong narrative that the Rohingya are not Burmese, that they are Bengali, that they came from Bangladesh, that they don't belong in Burma. People refuse to use the term Rohingya. They call them so-called Rohingya or Bengalis, or the term Kalar, which is a derogatory term used to refer to people often of Indian origin. There is also a big connection of them being Muslims, not Buddhists, and Muslims being equated with terrorism and violence. There's a lot of things on social media talking about other countries where there has been violence committed by Muslims, that Islam is a violent religion. There's a lot of dehumanizing sort of talk, comparing Muslims to dogs, to carp that breed and eat their young, to some of the other ones, to despicable fleas, I believe was one of them. There's a lot of that sort of talk that's been going on for quite some time. I think the most troubling aspect of it really is that a lot of this speech is coming not just from, you know, ordinary citizens, but it's coming from people with roles of respect in society. So a lot of it is actually coming from a group of Buddhist monks, and they are presenting this conflict with Muslims as a conflict for sort of the soul of Burma, for protection of Buddhism, to keep Burma a Buddhist country, to keep Burmese identity intact. And there's some of the most virulent hate speech has actually come out of Buddhist monks. And given the role and that Buddhist monks play and the reverence in which they're held, that makes that speech quite problematic. There also has been some very troubling speech coming from government officials, including members of the National League for Democracy, which is the ruling party. A lot of it, this whole idea that there are no Rohingya in Burma, that Rohingyas are not Burman, these are all Bengalis. That comes direct out of the mouth of government officials. That comes also out of the mouth of the commander-in-chief of the military, who as recently as last month said there are no Rohingya in Burma, and that we have to solve this Bengali problem. Now, he didn't say we're going to go kill all the Bengalis. Or he didn't say you should all go kill the Bengalis. But there is language of that type that has been coming from people in a position of authority, which makes it quite problematic. But in looking at certainly what we have, you know, what I have seen, and I have to say I haven't been able to do a sort of comprehensive review of hate speech, and most of it is in Burmese, which I didn't speak. So I've relied heavily on a Burmese-speaking colleague to call some of these examples. There hasn't been that much direct incitement to violence. And to the extent there has been direct incitement to violence, I don't think you would be able to tie it to the recent attacks in Rakhine State, which were in response to these attacks on a security post. Now, the response has been disproportionate. The response has been vicious. And there, you know, may someday be evidence that this was all pre-planned. We don't actually know. But at this point, to say that someone... to prosecute someone for actually inciting that, I think that would be a hard case to make. So I think I'll stop there unless people have questions.
These are great points and questions, and I will respond inadequately, but I'll do my best to respond directly to questions, because it's really annoying when speakers don't address the questions posed to them. But I accept, you know, some of the limitations that you've identified. Just to start with Arya Nair's questions about his free speech concern, whether Brandenburg is applicable because of the imminence requirement. And you're absolutely right, Arya, that Stryker is a questionable case. He was publisher of Der Stürmer, which has a circulation in 1933-4 of about 300,000. It's read by literally millions of Germans because it's put up in the town square on notice boards. But by the time the Second World War starts, it's gone down to 3,000. Stryker is under house arrest, and even Hitler considers him a crank. So the question is what kind of role does he play? Interestingly, he's convicted and hanged, whereas Hans Fritz, who was active during the war as number two to Goebbels, is acquitted. Now, the questions have been asked about that distinction, and I think we need to just take a step back and say, what was Stryker convicted for? He's the only defendant at Nuremberg convicted on one count, and that's count four of crimes against humanity. But being convicted of crimes against humanity, itself a very uncertain category of law at the time, doesn't tell us what the mode of liability is, whether it's perpetration, whether it's aiding and abetting, whether it's inciting, or what it is. So we actually don't know. What they cite in the judgment is his statement, and I think this is what gets him convicted and not Hans Fritz, who says nothing like this. Fritz is anti-Semitic, he's horrible, but he never says something like Stryker says in 1940-41, which is this: the Jews of the East must be exterminated root and branch. And he says this as at a moment when German troops are going into Poland and Eastern Europe and into Russia and exterminating the Jews of the East root and branch. And so I think that's what the judges identify as the speech act which incurs the criminal liability and rises to the level of a conviction for count four. Now, only afterwards, when interviews are made with the prosecutors, do the prosecutors, like Griffiths Jones, who's the British prosecutor, they identify the mode of liability. And Griffiths Jones says in an interview in the 60s that they were working off accomplice liability and complicity, which is different from incitement. And just a bit of nerdy minutia, Griffiths Jones, having convicted Stryker, goes on to prosecute Penguin Books in 1961 for publishing Lady Chatterley's Lover. You can't make this stuff up. Nadine's question about the applicability, if any, of Brandenburg. I like Brandenburg because I think it moved the United States First Amendment principles beyond mere advocacy. So in the 50s, you have these awful cases like Dennis. You have cases before the First World War like Whitney, where mere advocacy, and mostly it's socialists, and mostly it's Jewish socialists who are getting hammered with very repressive approaches to speech. The Red Scare in the 50s, merely advocating communism could get you thrown in jail until about 1961 or two. Just think about that. And Brandenburg is obviously a huge improvement on that because it has an imminence requirement and it has a likelihood requirement. So to go directly to Nadine's question, what application, if any, does Brandenburg, or what application does your work have to Brandenburg in the U.S.? Brandenburg, in the subsequent jurisprudence, there's a lot of definition of advocacy. So it can't just be abstract advocacy. It has to be specific crimes, specific acts that are committed. So there's a lot of jurisprudence on that. There's a lot of information about imminence. It has to be within 24 hours. It can't be just an indefinite period of time. That's Hess, 1973. There's very little on likelihood. That's the third prong. And the jurisprudence says almost nothing about what threshold of risk and likelihood there has to be. That's where I think the social science model comes in as relevant. And the factors that I delineated to you all, the 11 factors which need to be present for there to be a very strong likelihood, can give guidance to the courts on these matters. Now, you're right that judges don't like taking advice from social scientists, and they want to say junk science when they want to say it. But at the same time, U.S. judges and Supreme Court justices make empirical claims all the time about speech, completely unfounded. I'll give you two examples that come to mind. In Texas versus Johnson, which is a flag-burning case, they say taking offense doesn't necessarily elevate the risk of violence. It sounds totally implausible to me. I'll say it again. Taking offense does not elevate the risk that there'll be violence. Where's your empirical evidence for that claim? There isn't any. Here's another. RAV versus St. Paul, which is a cross-burning case. They say that insulting people on the basis of race or religion or ethnicity is not qualitatively different than any other form of insult, for instance, based on personal characteristics. Where's your evidence? That's a big claim. I'd like to see it. You may be right, but let's see some empirical evidence. How would you decide that, being a Supreme Court justice who went to Princeton, then Harvard, then back to Princeton again? Really, what do you know about how it feels to be insulted on the basis of religion, race, or any other form? You have to refer to the empirical evidence. You have to be a consumer of that information to some degree or another to make a verifiable claim about that. I'd like to see those claims better evidenced than they are. You asked a direct question, Nadine, about hate speech. Generally, Having worked in these contexts of genocide and armed conflict and crimes against humanities, I think a higher tolerance for hate speech in the domestic setting, particularly the U.S. setting. And generally, I would only want to see hate speech that has an additional call to imminent lawless action or an additional call to violence suppressed, and basically everything else, no matter how reprehensible or horrible, we probably have to let go on the grounds that there are other good reasons for doing that, and there are good reasons about having open political discourse on important questions and allowing people to express themselves in forceful and robust ways. But I think there are some difficult and gray areas. So just to give you a hypothetical, there is an angry mob outside a house of undocumented immigrants from Mexico in Brownsville, Texas. Let's say Donald Trump builds his wall. Let's say there is forced deportation of 11 million undocumented to Latin America. Let's say there's an angry mob outside the house in Brownsville, Texas. And an authority figure, a political party leader or a sheriff, comes up and says the words, you know, those undocumented Mexicans, they're the problem in this country. And that triggers a violent attack on the house or the persons, and there is harm to property and persons. It's not a call to violence explicitly. It's hate speech, but in that context, that's a hard case, I think. So my reply to Nadine was that most speech we have to let go, but there will be hard cases where hate speech is such an implicit call to violence in a particular context that we may have to consider it incitement, or an argument could be made that judges would have to hear. Coming to Marco's points, I accept all of that. You were the most critical, Marco, but that's fine. So most cases are not actionable, yes. My N is very small. Just to be clear, my N is 30 out of about 350 cases. So it's about 10% of all the cases. So you're right, it's small, but there is a number there of cases that one can speak about. Prevention is an optimistic scenario, and you're absolutely right, but I think I'm going to win over the audience more than you, you cynic, because this is the Open Society Foundation, for crying out loud. If there aren't optimists in this room, then I'm not going to find them. So I guess what I was trying to do was to say, what are the legal impediments to using the inchoate crime of incitement to genocide preventatively? And there is a major legal impediment, which is that the ICC statute includes it as a mode of liability and not a standalone crime. So we're not even going to have the conversation about prevention until that question is addressed. And I argue, along with some others, I'm not the first to think of this, that incitement to genocide needs to be placed very squarely in Article 5 and 6 and taken out of Article 25.3e. Or we need to rewrite 25.3e. I'm sorry, this is getting boring for the non-technicals here. We need to rewrite 25.3e so that it says inciting any of the crimes in the statute, which includes crimes against humanity, war crimes, and the crime of aggression. So you're right to point out that genocide excludes many people. It excludes the murder of nearly a million people in Indonesia in 1965. It neglects and omits the murder of communists in Latin America during the Cold War. It excludes the mass murder of the disabled and persons on the basis of sexuality. So one answer to that is to make an amendment which includes the incitement of all the crimes in the statute. Again, it's optimistic, I recognize that, but you got to try. Perpetrators don't read international criminal law. Really?
Damn, not your audience.
Well,
maybe they'll get the paper back.
So you're absolutely right, but I think the debate about, I think the actions of, and I don't have any evidence for this, but I expect that the recruitment of child soldiers has been chilled somewhat by the conviction of Lubanga, the conviction of Charles Taylor, and the ongoing trial of Dominic Ongwen. And no, actually, Charles Taylor probably did read international law, and probably does, when he has a lot of time, because he has a degree from Grinnell College. So I think that, yes, the deterrent effect is very hard to measure. It's very far down the road. But I would make the argument on the basis of no empirical evidence thus far that the ICC's focusing on this issue has trickled down to commanders in the field in certain African conflicts. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sandy, I'm looking at you. Can we continue for a few moments, or because we're at 7 o'clock?
Well, maybe we should say goodbye to Nadine, because I know you need to.
I will have to absent myself in 5 minutes to teach, but I'll stay until then.
Okay.
Okay,
let's go for 10 minutes. If there are a couple of questions from the floor. Yes, over here.
Thank you. With regard to the hypothetical, I think such a statement would be prosecutable as a hate crime in Western Europe, but not in the U.S., as would candidate Trump's statements about Muslims and about Mexicans. So which system do you think is better, and which would you like to see in the international system?
Yeah, pretty. So do you want me to take some questions?
Why don't you respond to that?
Section 130 of the German Criminal Code
criminalizes incitement to hatred, and many of these kinds of statements would be illegal. Which is preferable? It's hard to say. I can understand why Germany would want to create those criminal law provisions in the wake of the Second World War. Perhaps they were important and useful at the time. The suppression of denial of the Holocaust, I think, has served its purpose now and probably should be lifted and met with counter speech and not, of course, tolerated, but challenged. But criminalizing it is probably the wrong approach now, although I understand why that policy was chosen in the wake of the Second World War. It's not a question of which is better. I do take much of what Marco has to say about there being different kinds of political traditions and respecting those political traditions. We have a tradition of wide tolerance of speech, although it's not as long and as deep as many would like to imagine in the United States. I really think it's only about 50 years old. And you know, I would recall the Alien and Sedition Act of 1802 and the very strong suppression of speech really until the late 1950s, early 60s. And it's really a product of the civil rights movement and the efforts of individuals in the ACLU and others. I would say that even if Arya wasn't sitting next to me. Or I have said
and,
that.
And if I could also respond to that. And essentially repeat a point that Nadine made. When you criminalize hate speech, you have to recognize that the determination as to when to engage in prosecutions is going to be made by the law enforcement authorities who are in charge at a particular time. So we're dealing with a vast array of speech, and they're making a handful of selections as to which cases to pursue. So if the Hungarian Civil Liberties Union tells me that most of the cases of the prosecution of hate speech in Hungary are prosecutions of Roma for hate speech against ethnic Hungarians, it is because the prosecutors and the police in those circumstances are making the determinations as to when to invoke those powers. And one of the things about speech is there is inherent imprecision. you can't say that particular words are prohibited, because anybody can always come up with a word that will be readily understood by the audience. So if a speaker says, we need to prosecute the cows, we don't know ahead of time who the cows are, but instantly the audience makes a determination on the basis of what they know about the speaker and what the circumstances are at a particular time. So the concept of hate speech or prosecuting hate speech vests enormous discretion in the power of prosecutors. Now, maybe in Germany, they're going to exercise that power responsibly, and maybe in Hungary, they're not going to exercise that power responsibly. Or maybe there will be particular prosecutors in Germany who will not exercise that power responsibly. So one of the reasons that free speech advocates are very skeptical about criminalizing hate speech has to do with the discretion that is vested in law enforcement authorities.
And I thank you, Ari and Richard. If I could just add, because the hypothetical refers to the United States with a Trump administration, not a hypothetical, anniversary of the election today. So bear in mind that it would be the Trump administration at the national level and many Republicans, government officials throughout the country that would be making these inherently subjective determinations. And I can tell you from my research for my book that many people consider hate speech to be Black Lives Matter speech, right? We know that Donald Trump himself and others consider flag burning to be hate speech, to be taking the knee to be hate speech. So if we want to loosen up the standards and go back to what used to be the standard before the Supreme Court's desire to empower the civil rights movement opened up freedom of speech, make no mistake about it, it would be those, by and large, those who are advocating for immigrants' rights, for racial justice, for social justice reform, who would bear the brunt of the prosecutions.
Yeah, I would just endorse that. I mean, if you look at who gets prosecuted for fighting words and threat, it's in the hands of prosecutors and law enforcement, and it replicates all of the inequalities of the society in which the actions are embedded. Look at Gooding versus Wilson, which is a case of threat of an African-American inmate. You know, so I am aware of that that caution. At the same time, it's very interesting that this case is still ongoing. Guanguma, it's a case where Black Lives Matter protester is suing Trump and the Trump campaign, and that case is still ongoing. I would encourage you to look at the judge's decision where he grants the plaintiffs leave to bring their suit. That came out in about June. And then there was another opinion in August. And those are very well-written opinions applying Brandenburg to a March 6, 2016 rally at which Trump encouraged his supporters to get him out of here. And he used the expression, get him out of here, many times as protesters were being physically assaulted and being pushed out of the hall. And in fact, one of them, who's a Korean War veteran, who got expelled from his Veterans of Foreign Wars chapter, wrote a letter to them asking to be reinstated back into the chapter. And he said, you know, I heard Donald Trump saying this, and I wasn't going to do anything, but he told me to push him out of here. And that's why I did it. So you have, you know, for the lawyers bringing the case, you have the smoking memo of intentionality and mental causation that you're looking for. It'll be interesting to see where that case goes. It's not a criminal case. It's a civil case.
Okay. Jennifer Leaning's hand, and you get the last question.
I've done a fair number of human rights investigations in conflict, post-conflict, war-torn areas. And I would endorse the list of the social scientists and would say not in the legal context, certainly not within the United States, but in the context of the Rohingya and in many other countries and populations around the world, there is an early warning element of hate speech that the UN has adopted now, risk factors and trigger factors. It's a framework for the prevention of atrocity crimes, 2014. It's a really great list, very erudite and useful. And hate speech is there a trigger. Risk factors are others. And in my own experience, I think that, and it's not in your list exactly, but it's in, you hint at it when you're talking about Serbia, is the an honor code and a sense of humiliation. Humiliation and speech that evokes a sense of humiliation is extremely powerful. It's something that Benesch talks about in some of her work. And I think it's increasingly more relevant in the situations of Muslim countries where humiliation is a latent provocation of rage going back to World War I or earlier. And so I just endorse what you're saying. I think, Marco, your point about the law is, you know, far better than I, but I think this notion that kinds of speech that can provoke people to do bad things is becoming increasingly more important for us to look at, and not necessarily from prosecutorial edicts that then judgments that then create a sense of prohibition or constraint, but from the early warning community, which is more a political science and social science world, where you can say this country, this society is beginning to get to a boiling point. And we have many techniques for doing that, including data analysis of social media and the density as well as the characteristics of the speech. So I would really endorse your 11 points, and I think they're very important. And I think that that I understand now the difficulty of adjudicating this and litigating this in the context of the United States, but there are many other societies that are actually closer to firestorm, and there's a metaphor.
Okay. Richard, any final words? Or?
Thank you. I embrace all these points.
Okay. All right. We have gone past our allotted time. Again, I think the book is enormously important, and I recommend it highly. And I'm very grateful to Richard, to Marco, to Nadine, to Linda, and to those of you who took part as the audience for what I think was a stimulating discussion. Thank you very much.